other man, Mr. Ambrose Bierce, sitting very idly there, lighting matches and watching them burn down, whistling under his breath now and then, laughing to himself. "We'll have to tell Mr. Dickens now," said Mr. Poe. "We've put it off too long. It's a matter of hours. Will you go down to his home with me, Bierce?" Bierce glanced up merrily.
"I've just been thinking.
What'll happen to us? If we can't kill the rocket men off, frighten them away, then we'll have to leave, of course. We'll go on to Jupiter, and then they'll come to Jupiter. We'll go on to Saturn, and when they come to Saturn, we'll go to Uranus, or Neptune, and then on out to Pluto.
Where then?"
Mr. Poe's face was weary. There were fire coals remaining, fading in his eyes, and a sad wildness in the way he talked, and a uselessness of his hands, and the way his hair fell lanky over his amazing white brow. He was like a Satan of some lost dark cause, a general arrived from a derelict invasion. His silky, soft black mustache was worn away by his musing lips. He was so small his brow seemed to float, vast and phosphorescent by itself in the dark room. "We have the advantages of superior forms of travel," he said. "We can always hope for one of their atomic wars, dissolution, the Dark Ages come again, the return of superstition. We could go back then to Earth, all of us, in one night." Mr. Poe's black eyes brooded under his round and luminant brow. He gazed at the ceiling. "So they're coming to ruin this world, too. They won't leave anything undefiled, will they?"
"Does a wolf pack stop until it's killed its prey and eaten the guts?" "It should be quite a war. I shall sit on the sidelines and be the scorekeeper. So many Earthmen boiled in oil, so many manuscripts found in bottles burnt, so many Earthmen stabbed with needles, so many red deaths put to flight by a batter of hypodermic syringes, ha!"
Poe swayed angrily, faintly drunk with wine. "What did we do? Be with us, Bierce, in the name of God. Did we have a fair trial before a company of literary critics? No! Our books were plucked up by neat, sterile surgeons' pliers, and flung into vats to boil, to be killed of all their mortuary germs. Damn them all!"
"I find our situation amusing," said Bierce.
They were interrupted by a hysterical shout from the tower stair. "Mr. Poe! Mr. Bierce!" "Yes, yes, we're coming!" Poe and Bierce descended to find a man gasping against the stone passage wall. "Have you heard the news?" he cried immediately, clawing at them like a man about to fall over a cliff. "In an hour, they'll land. They're bringing books with them, old books, the witches said. What are you doing in the tower at a time like this? Why aren't you acting?" Poe said, "We're doing everything we can, Blackwood. You're new to all this. Come along. We're going to Mr. Charles Dickens' place
to contemplate our doom, our black doom," said Bierce with a wink.
They moved down the echoing throats of the castle, level after dim green level, down into mustiness and decay and spiders and dreamlike webbing. "Don't worry," said Poe, his brow like a huge white lamp before them, descending, sinking. "All along the Dead Sea tonight I've called the others. Your friends and mine, Blackwood, Bierce. They're all there. The animals, and the old women, and the tall men with the sharp white teeth. The traps are waiting. The pits, yes, and the pendulums. The Red Death." Here he laughed quietly. "Yes, even the Red Death. I never thought the time would come when a thing like the Red Death would actually be. But they asked for it, and they shall have it."
"But are we strong enough?" wondered Blackwood.
"How strong is strong?
They won't be prepared for us, at least. They haven't the imagination, those clean young rocket men with their antiseptic bloomers and fishbowl helmets, with their new religion. About their necks on gold chains, scalpels. Upon their heads, a diadem of microscopes. In their holy fingers, steaming incense urns, which in reality are only germicidal ovens for steaming out superstition. The names of Poe, Bierce, Hawthorne, Blackwood, blasphemy to their clean lips.
Outside the castle, they advanced through a watery space, a tarn that was not a tarn, which misted before them like the stuff of nightmares. The air filled with wing sounds and a whirring, a motion of winds and blacknesses. Voices changed, figures swayed at campfires. Mr. Poe watched the needles knitting, knitting, knitting in the firelight, knitting pain and misery, knitting wickedness into wax marionettes, clay puppets. The cauldron smells of wild garlic and cayenne and saffron hissed up to fill the night with evil pungency.
"Get on with it," said Poe. "I'll be back."
All down the empty seashore, black figures spindled and waned, grew up and blew into black smoke on the sky. Bells rang in mountain towers, and licorice ravens spilled out with the bronze sounds and spun away to ashes. Over a lonely moor, and into a small valley, Poe and Bierce hurried, and found themselves quite suddenly on a cobbled street in cold, bleak, biting weather, with people stomping up and down stony courtyards to warm their feet, foggy withal, and candles flaring in the windows of offices and shops where hung the Yuletide turkeys. At a distance, some boys, all bundled up, snorting their pale breaths on the wintry air, were trilling, "God rest ye merry gentlemen," while the immense tones of a great clock continuously sounded midnight. Children dashed by from the bakers with dinners all asteam in their grubby fists on trays and under silver bowls. At a sign which read, "Scrooge, Marley, and Dickens," Poe gave the Marley-faced knocker a rap, and from within, as the door popped open a few inches, a sudden gust of music almost swept them into a dance. And there, beyond the shoulder of the man who was sticking a trim goatee and mustaches at them, was Mr. Fezziwig clapping his hands, and Mrs. Fezziwig, one vast substantial smile dancing and colliding with other merrymakers, while the fiddle chirped and laughter ran about a table like chandelier crystals given a sudden push of wind. The large table was heaped with brawn and turkey and holly and geese, with mince pies, suckling pigs, wreaths of sausages, oranges and apples, and there was Bob Cratchit and Little Dorrit, and Tiny Tim and Mr. Fagin himself, and a man who looked as if he might be an undigested bit of beef, a blot of mustard, a crumb of cheese, a fragment of an underdone potato, who else but Mr. Marley, chains and all, while the wine poured and the brown turkeys did their excellent best to steam.
"What do you want?" demanded Mr. Charles Dickens.
"We've come to plead with you again, Charles. We need your help," said Poe.
"Help? Do you think I would help you fight against those good men coming in the rocket? I don't belong here anyway. My books were burned by mistake. I'm no supernaturalist, no writer of horrors and terrors like you, Poe, you Bierce, or the others. I'll have nothing to do with you terrible people."
"You are a persuasive talker," reasoned Poe. "You could go to meet the rocket men, lull them, lull their suspicions, and then we would take care of them."
Mr. Dickens eyed the folds of the black cape which hid Poe's hands. From it,
Smiling, Poe drew forth a black cat. For one of our visitors. And for the others? Poe smiled again, well pleased. The premature burial? You are a grim man, Mr. Poe. I am a frightened and an angry man. I am a god, Mr. Dickens, even as you are a god, even as we all are gods, and our inventions, our people, if you wish, have not only been threatened, but banished and burned, torn up and censored, ruined and done away with. The worlds we created are falling into ruin. Even gods must fight. So? Mr. Dickens tilted his head, impatient to return to the party, the music, the food. Perhaps you can explain why we are here. How did we come here? War begets war. Destruction begets destruction. On Earth, a century ago, in the year 2020, they outlawed our books. Oh, what a horrible thing to destroy our literary creations that way! It summoned us out of, what, death? The beyond? I don't like abstract things. I don't know. I only know that our worlds and our creations called us, and we tried to save them. And the only saving thing we could do was to wait out the century here on Mars, hoping Earth might overweight itself with these scientists and their doubtings. But now they're coming to clean us out of here. Us and our dark things. And all the alchemists, witches, vampires, and werethings that one by one retreated across space as science made inroads through every country on Earth and finally left no alternative at all but exodus. You must help us. You have a good speaking manner. We need you. I repeat, I am not of you. I don't approve of you and the others, cried Dickens angrily. I was no player with witches and vampires and midnight things. What of a Christmas carol? Ridiculous. One story. Oh, I wrote a few others about ghosts, perhaps, but what of that? My basic works had none of that nonsense. Mistaken or not, they grouped you with us. They destroyed your books, your worlds, too. You must hate them, Mr. Dickens. I admit they are stupid and rude. But that is all. Good day. Let Mr. Marley come, at least. No. The door slammed. As Poe turned away down the street, skimming over the frosty ground, the coachman playing a lively air on a bugle, came a great coach, out of which Cherry Red, laughing and singing, piled the Pickwickians, banging on the door, shouting Merry Christmas good and loud, when the door was opened by the fat boy. Mr. Poe hurried along the midnight shore of the dry sea. By fires and smoke he hesitated to shout orders, to check the bubbling cauldrons, the poisons, and the chalked pentagrams. Good, he said, and ran on. Fine, he shouted, and ran again. People joined him and ran with him. Here were Mr. Coppard and Mr. Macon, running with him now. And there were hating serpents and angry demons, and fiery bronze dragons and spitting vipers, and trembling witches like the barbs and nettles and thorns, and all the vile flotsam and jetsam of the retreating sea of imagination left on the melancholy shore, whining and frothing and spitting. Mr. Macon stopped. He sat like a child in the cold sand. He began to sob. They tried to soothe him, but he would not listen.
I just thought, he said, what happens to us on the day when the last copies of our books are destroyed.
The air whirled. Don't speak of it.
We must, wailed Mr. Macon. Now, as the rocket comes down, you, Mr. Poe, you, Coppard, you, Bierce, all of you grow faint, like wood smoke,
blowing away. Your faces melt.
Death. Real death for all of us.
We exist only through Earth's sufferance. If a final edict tonight destroyed our last few works, we'd be like lights put out.
Coppard brooded gently. I wonder who I am. In what Earth mind tonight do I exist? In some African hut? Some hermit reading my tales? Is he the lonely candle in the wind of time and science? The flickering orb sustaining me here in rebellious exile? Is it him, or some boy in a discarded attic finding me, only just in time? Oh, last night I fell ill, 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 to the marrows of me, for there is a body of the soul as well as a body of the body, and this soul-body ached in all of its glowing parts. And last night I felt myself a candle, guttering, when suddenly I sprang up, given new light. As some child, sneezing with dust, in some yellow garret on earth, once more found a worn, time-specked copy of me. And so I'm given a short respite.
A door banged wide in a little hut by the shore. A thin, short man, with flesh hanging from him in folds, stepped out, and, paying no attention to the others, sat down and stared into his clenched fists.
"There's the one I'm sorry for,"
whispered Blackwood.
"Look at him, dying away. He was once more real than we who were men. They took him, a skeleton thought, and clothed him in centuries of pink flesh and snow beard and red velvet suit and black boot, made him reindeers, tinsel, holly. And after centuries of manufacturing him, they drowned him in a vat of Lysol, you might say."
The men were silent. "What must it be on earth?" wondered Poe. "Without Christmas. No hot chestnuts, no tree, no ornaments or drums or candles, nothing, nothing but the snow and wind and the lonely factual people." They all looked at the thin little old man with the scraggly beard and faded red velvet suit.
"Have you heard his story?"
"I can imagine it. The glitter-eyed psychiatrist, the clever sociologist, the resentful, froth-mouthed educationalist, the antiseptic parents—"
"A regrettable situation," said Bierce, smiling, "for the Yuletide merchants who, toward the last there, as I recall, were beginning to put up holly and sing Noel the day before Halloween. With any luck at all this year, they might have started on Labor Day."
Bierce did not continue. He fell forward with a sigh. As he lay upon the ground, he had time to say only, "How interesting!" And then, as they all watched, horrified, his body burned into blue dust and charred bone, the ashes of which fled through the air in black tatters.
"Bierce? Bierce?"
"Gone."
"His last book gone. Someone on earth just now burned it."
"God rest him. Nothing of him left now. For what are we but books? And when those are gone, nothing's to be seen."
A rushing sound filled the sky. They cried out, terrified, and looked up. In the sky, dazzling it with sizzling fire clouds, was the rocket. Around the men on the seashore, lanterns bobbed. There was a squealing and a bubbling and an odor of cooked spells. Candle-eyed pumpkins lifted into the cold, clear air, thin fingers clenched into fists, and a witch screamed from her withered mouth, "Ship! Ship! Break! Fall! Ship! Ship! Burn all! Crack! Flake! Shake! Melt! Mummy dust! Cat pelt!"
"Time to go," murmured Blackwood. "Onto Jupiter. Onto Saturn or Pluto."
"Run away?" shouted Poe in the wind. "Never!
I'm a tired old man.
Poe gazed into the old man's face and believed him. He climbed atop a huge boulder and faced the 10,000 gray shadows and green lights and yellow eyes on the hissing wind.
The powders!
He shouted. A thick, hot smell of bitter almond, civet, cumin, worm seed, and orris. The rocket came down, steadily down, with the shriek of a damned spirit. Poe raged at it. He flung his fists up, and the orchestra of heat and smell and hatred answered in symphony. Like stripped tree fragments, bats flew upward. Burning hearts flung like missiles, burst in bloody fireworks on the singed air. Down, down, relentlessly down, like a pendulum the rocket came. And Poe howled furiously and shrank back with every sweep and sweep of the rocket cutting and ravening the air. All the Dead Sea seemed a pit in which, trapped, they waited the sinking of the dread machinery, the glistening axe. They were people under the avalanche. "The snakes!" screamed Poe. And luminous serpentines of undulant green hurtled toward the rocket. But it came down, a sweep, a fire, a motion, and it lay panting out exhaustions of red plumage on the sand a mile away. "At it!" shrieked Poe. "The plan's changed! Only one chance! Run! At it! At it! Drown them with our bodies! Kill them!" And as if he had commanded a violent sea to change its course, to suck itself free from primeval beds, the whirls and savage gouts of fire spread and ran like wind and rain and stark lightning over the sea sands, down empty river deltas, shadowing and screaming, whistling and whining, sputtering and coalescing toward the rocket which, extinguished, lay like a clean metal torch in the farthest hollow. As if a great charred cauldron of sparkling lava had been overturned, the boiling people and snapping animals churned down the dry fathoms. "Kill them!" screamed Poe, running. The rocket men leaped out of their ship, guns ready. They stalked about, sniffing the air like hounds. They saw nothing. They relaxed. The captain stepped forth last. He gave sharp commands. Wood was gathered, kindled, and a fire leapt up in an instant. The captain beckoned his men into a half-circle about him. "A new world," he said, forcing himself to speak deliberately, though he glanced nervously now and again over his shoulder at the empty sea. "The old world left behind. A new start. What more symbolic than that we here dedicate ourselves all the more firmly to science and progress?" He nodded crisply to his lieutenant. "The books." Firelight limned the faded gilt titles. "The Willows," "The Outsider," "Behold," "The Dreamer," "Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde," "The Land of Oz," "Pellucidar," "The Land That Time Forgot," "A Midsummer Night's Dream," and the monstrous names of Machen and Edgar Allan Poe, and Cabell, and Dunsany, and Blackwood, and Lewis Carroll. The names, the old names, the evil names. "A new world. With a gesture we burn the last of the old." The captain ripped pages from the books. Leaf by seared leaf, he fed them into the fire. A scream. Leaping back, the men stared beyond the firelight at the edges of the encroaching and uninhabited sea. Another scream, a high and wailing thing like the death of a dragon and the thrashing of a bronzed whale left gasping when the waters of a leviathan sea drain down the shingles and evaporate. It was the sound of air rushing in to fill a vacuum where, a moment before, there had been something. The captain neatly disposed of the last book by putting it into the fire.
The air stopped quivering. Silence. The rocket men leaned and listened.
Captain, did you hear it?
No.
Like a wave, sir. On the sea bottom. I thought I saw something over there. A black wave, big, running at us.
You were mistaken.
There, sir.
What?
See it? There, the city, way over. That green city near the lake. It's splitting in half. It's falling.
The men squinted and shuffled forward. Smith stood trembling among them. He put his hand to his head as if to find a thought there.
I remember. Yes, now I do. A long time back, when I was a child, a book I read, a story. Oz, I think it was. Yes, Oz. The Emerald City of Oz.
Oz? Never heard of it.
Yes. Oz, that's what it was. I saw it just now, like in the story. I saw it fall.
Smith?
Yes, sir?
Report for psychoanalysis tomorrow.
Yes, sir.
A brisk salute.
Be careful.
The men tiptoed, guns alert, beyond the ship's aseptic light to gaze at the long sea and the low hills.
Why, whispered Smith, disappointed. There's no one here at all, is there? No one here at all.
The wind blew sand over his shoes, whining. No particular night or morning. He had smoked a packet of cigarettes in 2 hours.
How far out in space are we?
1 billion miles.
1 billion miles from where?
Said Hitchcock. It all depends, said Clemens, not smoking at all. 1 billion miles from home, you might say.
Then say it.
Home, Earth, New York, Chicago, wherever you were from.
I don't even remember, said Hitchcock. I don't even believe there is an Earth now, do you?
Yes, said Clemens. I dreamt about it this morning.
There is no morning in space.
During the night, then.
It's always night, said Hitchcock quietly. Which night do you mean?
Shut up, said Clemens irritably. Let me finish. Hitchcock lit another cigarette. His hand did not shake, but it looked as if, inside the sun-burned flesh, it might be tremoring all to itself, a small tremor in each hand, and a large, invisible tremor in his body. The two men sat on the observation corridor floor, looking out at the stars. Clemens's eyes flashed, but Hitchcock's eyes focused on nothing. They were blank and puzzled.
I woke up at 0500 hours myself, said Hitchcock, as if he were talking to his right hand. And I heard myself screaming, where am I, where am I? And the answer was, nowhere. And I said, where have I been? And I said, Earth. What's Earth, I wondered. Where I was born, I said. But it was nothing, and worse than nothing. I don't believe in anything I can't see or hear or touch. I can't see Earth, so why should I believe in it? It's safer this way not to believe.
There's Earth, Clemens pointed, smiling. That point of light there.
That's not Earth. That's our sun. You can't see Earth from here.
I can see it. I have a good memory.
It's not the same, you fool, said Hitchcock suddenly. There was a touch of anger in his voice. I mean see it. I've always been that way. When I'm in Boston, New York is dead. When I'm in New York, Boston is dead. When I don't see a man for a day, he's dead.
When he comes walking down the street, my God, it's a resurrection. I do a dance almost. I'm so glad to see him. I used to, anyway. I don't dance anymore. I just look. And when the man walks off, he's dead again. Clemens laughed. It's simply that your mind works on a primitive level. You can't hold to things. You've got no imagination, Hitchcock, old man. You've got to learn to hold on. Why should I hold on to things I can't use? Said Hitchcock, his eyes wide, still staring into space. I'm practical. If Earth isn't here for me to walk on, you want me to walk on a memory? That hurts. Memories, as my father once said, are porcupines. To hell with them. Stay away from them. They make you unhappy. They ruin your work. They make you cry. I'm walking on Earth right now, said Clemens, squinting to himself, blowing smoke.
You're kicking porcupines. Later in the day you won't be able to eat lunch and you'll wonder why, said Hitchcock in a dead voice. And it'll be because you've got a foot full of quills aching in you. To hell with it. If I can't drink it, pinch it, punch it, or lie on it, then I say drop it in the sun. I'm dead to Earth. It's dead to me. There's no one in New York weeping for me tonight. Shove New York. There isn't any season here. Winter and summer are gone. So is spring and autumn. It isn't any particular night or morning. It's space and space. The only thing right now is you and me and this rocket ship. And the only thing I'm positive of is me. That's all of it.
Clemens ignored this. I'm putting a dime in the phone slot right now, he said, pantomiming it with a slow smile. And calling my girl in Evanston. Hello, Barbara. The rocket sailed on through space. The lunch bell rang at 13:05 hours. The men ran by on soft rubber sneakers and sat at the cushioned tables. Clemens wasn't hungry.
See, what did I tell you? Said Hitchcock. You and your damned porcupines. Leave them alone like I told you. Look at me, shoveling away food.
He said this with a mechanical, slow, and unhumorous voice. Watch me. He put a big piece of pie in his mouth and felt it with his tongue. He looked at the pie on his plate as if to see the texture. He moved it with his fork. He felt the fork handle. He mashed the lemon filling and watched it jet up between the tines. Then he touched a bottle of milk all over and poured out half a quart into a glass, listening to it. He looked at the milk as if to make it whiter. He drank the milk so swiftly that he couldn't have tasted it. He had eaten his entire lunch in a few minutes, cramming it in feverishly, and now he looked around for more, but it was gone. He gazed out the window of the rocket, blankly.
Those aren't real either, he said.
What? Asked Clemens.
The stars?
Who's ever touched one?
I can see them, sure, but what's the use of seeing a thing that's a million or a billion miles away? Anything that far off isn't worth bothering with.
Why did you come on this trip? Asked Clemens suddenly. Hitchcock peered into his amazingly empty milk glass and clenched it tight, then relaxed his hand and clenched it again.
I don't know.
He ran his tongue on the glass rim.
I just had to, is all. How do you know why you do anything in this life?
You like the idea of space travel, going places?
I don't know. Yes.
No.
It wasn't going places. It was being between.
Hitchcock, for the first time, tried to focus his eyes upon something, but it was so nebulous and far off that his eyes couldn't make the adjustment, though he worked his face and hands.
Mostly it was space.
So much space. I liked the idea of nothing on top, nothing on the bottom, and a lot of nothing in between, and me in the middle of the nothing. I never heard it put that way before. I just put it that way. I hope you listened. Hitchcock took out his cigarettes and lit up and began to suck and blow the smoke again and again. Clemens said, "What sort of childhood did you have, Hitchcock?" "I was never young. Whoever I was then is dead. That's more of your quills. I don't want to hide full thanks. I've always figured it that you die each day, and each day is a box, you see, all numbered and neat. But never go back and lift the lids, because you've died a couple of thousand times in your life, and that's a lot of corpses, each dead a different way, each with a worse expression. Each of those days is a different you, somebody you don't know or understand or want to understand. You're cutting yourself off that way. Why should I have anything to do with that younger Hitchcock? He was a fool, and he was yanked around and taken advantage of and used. His father was no good, and he was glad when his mother died, because she was the same. Should I go back and see his face on that day and gloat over it? He was a fool. We're all fools, said Clemens, all the time. It's just we're a different kind each day. We think, I'm not a fool today, I've learned my lesson. I was a fool yesterday, but not this morning. Then tomorrow we find out that, yes, we were a fool today, too. I think the only way we can grow and get on in this world is to accept the fact that we're not perfect and live accordingly. I don't want to remember imperfect things, said Hitchcock. I can't shake hands with that younger Hitchcock, can I? Where is he? Can you find him for me? He's dead, so to hell with him. I won't shape what I do tomorrow by some lousy thing I did yesterday. You've got it wrong. Let me have it, then. Hitchcock sat, finished with his meal, looking out the port. The other men glanced at him. Do meteors exist? Asked Hitchcock. You know damn well they do. In our radar machines, yes, as streaks of light in space. No, I don't believe in anything that doesn't exist and act in my presence. Sometimes, he nodded at the men finishing their food. Sometimes, I don't believe in anyone or anything but me. He sat up. Is there an upstairs to this ship? Yes. I've got to see it immediately. Don't get excited. You wait here. I'll be right back. Hitchcock walked out swiftly. The other men sat nibbling their food slowly. A moment passed. One of the men raised his head.
How long's this been going on? I mean, Hitchcock.
Just today.
He acted funny the other day, too.
Yes, but it's worse today.
Has anyone told the psychiatrist?
We thought he'd come out of it. Everyone has a little touch of space the first time out. I've had it. You get wildly philosophical, then frightened. You break into a sweat. Then you doubt your parentage. You don't believe in Earth. You get drunk, wake up with a hangover, and that's it.
But Hitchcock don't get drunk, said someone.
I wish he would.
How do you ever get past the examining board?
How do we all get past? They need men. Space scares the hell out of most people, so the board lets a lot of borderlines through.
That man isn't a borderline, said someone. He's a fall off a cliff and no bottom to hit.
They waited for 5 minutes. Hitchcock didn't come back. Clemens finally got up and went out and climbed the circular stairs to the flight deck above. Hitchcock was there, touching the wall tenderly.
It's here, he said.
Of course it is.
I was afraid it might not be.
Hitchcock peered at Clemens.
And you're alive.
I have been for a long time.
No,
said Hitchcock.
Now, just now, this instant, while you're here with me, you're alive. A moment ago, you weren't anything.
I was to me, said the other.
That's not important. You weren't here with me, said Hitchcock. Only that's important. Is the crew down below?
Yes.
Can you prove it?
Look, Hitchcock, you'd better see Dr. Edwards. I think you need a little servicing.
No, I'm all right. Who's the doctor anyway? Can you prove he's on this ship?
I can. All I have to do is call him.
No, I mean standing here, in this instant. You can't prove he's here, can you?
Not without moving, I can't.
You see? You have no mental evidence. That's what I want, a mental evidence I can feel. I don't want physical evidence, proof you have to go out and drag in. I want evidence that you can carry in your mind and always touch and smell and feel, but there's no way to do that. In order to believe in a thing, you've got to carry it with you. You can't carry the earth or a man in your pocket. I want a way to do that. Carry things with me always so I can believe in them. How clumsy to have to go to all the trouble of going out and bringing in something terribly physical to prove something. I hate physical things because they can be left behind and become impossible to believe in them.
Those are the rules of the game.
I want to change them. Wouldn't it be fine if we could prove things with our mind and know for certain that things are always in their place? I'd like to know what a place is like when I'm not there. I'd like to be sure.
That's not possible.
You know, said Hitchcock, I first got the idea of coming out into space about 5 years ago, about the time I lost my job. Did you know I wanted to be a writer?
Oh, yes. One of those men who always talk about writing, but rarely write.
And too much temper. So I lost my good job and left the editorial business and couldn't get another job and went on downhill. Then my wife died. You see, nothing stays where you put it. You can't trust material things. I had to put my boy in an aunt's trust, and things got worse. And one day I had a story published with my name on it, but it wasn't me.
I don't get you.
Hitchcock's face was pale and sweating. I can only say that I looked at the page with my name under the title, By Joseph Hitchcock. But it was some other man. There was no way to prove, actually prove, really prove, that that man was me. The story was familiar, I knew I had written it, but that name on the paper still was not me. It was a symbol, a name. It was alien, and then I realized that even if I did become successful at writing, it would never mean a thing to me, because I couldn't identify myself with that name. It would be soot and ashes, so I didn't write any more. I was never sure, anyway, that the stories I had in my desk a few days later were mine. Though I remembered typing them, there was always that gap of proof, that gap between doing and having done. What is done is dead and is not proof, for it is not an action. Only actions are important. And pieces of paper were remains of actions done and over and now unseen. The proof of doing was over and done. Nothing but memory remained, and I didn't trust my memory. Could I actually prove I had written these stories? No. Can any author? I mean proof. I mean action as proof. No. Not really. Not unless someone sits in the room while you type, and then maybe you're doing it from memory. And once a thing is accomplished, there is no proof, only memory. So then I begin to find gaps between everything. I doubted I was married, or had a child, or ever had a job in my life. I doubted that I had been born in Illinois and had a drunken father and swinish mother. I couldn't prove anything. Oh, yes, people could say, you are thus and such, but that was nothing.
You should get your mind off stuff like that, said Clemens.
I can't. All the gaps and spaces. And that's how I got to thinking about the stars. I thought how I'd like to be in a rocket ship in space, in nothing, going on into nothing, with just a thin something, a thin eggshell of metal holding me,
going on away from all the somethings with gaps in them that couldn't prove themselves. I knew then that the only happiness for me was space. When I get to Adelbaran II, I'll sign up to return on the 5-year journey to Earth and so go back and forth like a shuttlecock all the rest of my life. Have you talked about this to the psychiatrist?
So he could try to mortar up the gaps for me, fill in the gulfs with noise and warm water and words and hands touching me and all that? No thanks.
Hitchcock stopped.
I'm getting worse, aren't I? I thought so. This morning when I woke up, I thought, I'm getting worse. Or is it better?
He paused again and cocked an eye at Clemens.
Are you there? Are you really there? Go on. Prove it.
Clemens slapped him on the arm hard.
Yes, said Hitchcock, rubbing his arm, looking at it very thoroughly, wonderingly, massaging it. You were there, for a brief fraction of an instant, but I wonder if you are... now.
See you later, said Clemens. He was on his way to find the doctor. He walked away. A bell rang, 2 bells, 3 bells rang. The ship rocked as if a hand had slapped it. There was a sucking sound, the sound of a vacuum cleaner turned on. Clemens heard the screams and felt the air thin. The air hissed away about his ears. Suddenly there was nothing in his nose or lungs. He stumbled, and then the hissing stopped. He heard someone cry, "A meteor!" Another said, "It's patched!" And this was true. The ship's emergency spider running over the outside of the hull had slapped a hot patch on the hole in the metal and welded it tight. Someone was talking, and then beginning to shout at a distance. Clemens ran along the corridor through the freshening, thickening air. As he turned in at a bulkhead, he saw the hole in the steel wall, freshly sealed. He saw the meteor fragments lying about the room like bits of a toy. He saw the captain and the members of the crew, and a man lying on the floor. It was Hitchcock. His eyes were closed, and he was crying.
"It tried to kill me,"
he said, over and over.
"It tried to kill me."
They got him on his feet.
"You can't do that," said Hitchcock. "That's not how it should be. Things like that can't happen, can they? It came in after me. Why did it do that?"
All right, Hitchcock," said the captain.
The doctor was bandaging a small cut on Hitchcock's arm. Hitchcock looked up, his face pale, and saw Clemens there looking at him.
"It tried to kill me," he said.
"I know," said Clemens. 17 hours passed. The ship moved on in space. Clemens stepped through a bulkhead and waited. The psychiatrist and the captain were there. Hitchcock sat on the floor with his legs drawn up to his chest, arms wrapped tight about them.
"Hitchcock," said the captain.
No answer. "Hitchcock, listen to me," said the psychiatrist. They turned to Clemens.
"You're his friend?"
"Yes."
"Do you want to help us?"
"If I can."
"It was that damned meteor," said the captain. "This might not have happened if it hadn't been for that."
"It would have come anyway, sooner or later," said the doctor.
To Clemens,
"You might talk to him."
Clemens walked quietly over and crouched by Hitchcock and began to shake his arm gently, calling in a low voice,
"Hey there, Hitchcock."
No reply.
"Hey, it's me."
"Me, Clemens," said Clemens.
"Look, I'm here."
He gave the arm a little slap. He massaged the rigid neck gently, and the back of the bent-down head.
He glanced at the psychiatrist, who sighed very softly. The captain shrugged.
Shock treatment, doctor?
The psychiatrist nodded.
We'll start within the hour.
Yes, thought Clemens, shock treatment. Play a dozen jazz records for him, wave a bottle of fresh green chlorophyll and dandelions under his nose, put grass under his feet, squirt Chanel on the air, cut his hair, clip his fingernails, bring him a woman, shout, bang and crash at him, fry him with electricity, fill the gap and the gulf. But where's your proof? You can't keep proving to him forever. You can't entertain a baby with rattles and sirens all night every night for the next 30 years. Sometimes you've got to stop. When you do that, he's lost again. That is, if he pays any attention to you at all.
Hitchcock! He cried as loud as he could, almost frantically, as if he himself were falling over a cliff. It's me! It's your pal! Hey!
Clemens turned and walked away, out of the silent room. 12 hours later, another alarm bell rang. After all of the running had died down, the captain explained, Hitchcock snapped out of it for a minute or so. He was alone. He climbed into a spacesuit. He opened an airlock. Then he walked out into space. Alone. Clemens blinked through the immense glass port, where there was a blur of stars and distant blackness.
He's out there now?
Yes. 1,000,000 miles behind us. We'd never find him. First time I knew he was outside the ship was when his helmet radio came in on our control room beam. I heard him talking to himself.
What did he say?
Something like, no more spaceship now, never was any, no people in all the universe, never were any, no plants, no stars. That's what he said. And then he said something about his hands and feet and legs. No hands, he said. I haven't any hands anymore, never had any. No feet, never had any. Can't prove it. No body, never had any, no lips, no face, no head, nothing. Only space. Only the gap. The men turned quietly to look from the glass port out into the remote and cold stars. Space, thought Clemens. The space that Hitchcock loved so well. Space. With nothing on top, nothing on the bottom. A lot of empty nothings between, and Hitchcock falling in the middle of the nothing. On his way to no particular night and no particular morning. The Fox and the Forest. There were fireworks the very first night, things that you should be afraid of, perhaps, for they might remind you of other more horrible things, but these were beautiful. Rockets that ascended into the ancient soft air of Mexico and shook the stars apart in blue and white fragments. Everything was good and sweet. The air was that blend of the dead and the living, of the rains and the dusts, of the incense from the church and the brass smell of the tubas on the bandstand which pulsed out vast rhythms of La Paloma. The church doors were thrown wide, and it seemed as if a giant yellow constellation had fallen from the October sky and lay breathing fire upon the church walls. 1,000,000 candles sent their color and fumes about. Newer and better fireworks scurried like tightrope-walking comets across the cool tiled square, banged against adobe cafe walls, then rushed on hot wires to bash the high church tower, in which boys' naked feet alone could be seen kicking and re-kicking, clanging and tilting and re-tilting the monster bells into monstrous music. A flaming bull blundered about the plaza, chasing laughing men and screaming children. "The year is 1938. said William Travis, standing by his wife on the edge of the yelling crowd, smiling. A good year. The bull rushed upon them. Ducking, the couple ran, with fireballs pelting them, past the music and riot, the church, the band, under the stars, clutching each other, laughing. The bull passed, carried lightly on the shoulders of a charging Mexican, a framework of bamboo and sulphurous gunpowder.
"I've never enjoyed myself so much in my life."
Susan Travis had stopped for her breath.
"It's amazing," said William. "It will go on, won't it?"
"All night."
"No, I mean our trip."
He frowned and patted his breast pocket. "I have enough traveler's checks for a lifetime. Enjoy yourself. Forget it. They'll never find us."
"Never?"
"Never." Now someone was setting off giant crackers, hurling them from the great bell-tolling tower of the church in a sputter of smoke, while the crowd below fell back under the threat, and the crackers exploded in wonderful concussions among their dancing feet and flailing bodies. A wondrous smell of frying tortillas hung all about, and in the cafes men sat at tables looking out, mugs of beer in their brown hands. The bull was dead. The fire was out of the bamboo tubes, and he was expended. The laborer lifted the framework from his shoulders. Little boys clustered to touch the magnificent papier-mâché head, the real horns.
"Let's examine the bull," said William.
As they walked past the cafe entrance, Susan saw the man looking out at them, a white man in a salt-white suit, with a blue tie and blue shirt, and a thin, sunburned face. His hair was blonde and straight, and his eyes were blue, and he watched them as they walked. She would never have noticed him if it had not been for the bottles at his immaculate elbow, a fat bottle of crème de menthe, a clear bottle of vermouth, a flagon of cognac, and seven other bottles of assorted liquors, and, at his fingertips, 10 small half-filled glasses from which, without taking his eyes off the street, he sipped, occasionally squinting, pressing his thin mouth shut upon the savor. In his free hand a thin Havana cigar smoked, and on a chair stood 20 cartons of Turkish cigarettes, 6 boxes of cigars, and some packaged colognes.
"Bill,"
whispered Susan.
"Take it easy,"
he said. "He's nobody."
"I saw him in the plaza this morning."
"Don't look back. Keep walking. Examine the papier-mâché bull here. That's it. Ask questions."
"Do you think he's from the searchers?"
"They couldn't follow us."
"They might."
"What a nice bull," said William to the man who owned it.
"He couldn't have followed us back through 200 years, could he?"
"Watch yourself, for God's sake," said William. She swayed. He crushed her elbow tightly, steering her away. "Don't faint." He smiled to make it look good. "You should be all right. Let's go right in that cafe, drink in front of him, so if he is what we think he is, he won't suspect."
"No, I couldn't."
"We've got to. Come on now." "And so I said to David, that's ridiculous." This last in a loud voice as they went up the cafe steps. "We are here," thought Susan. "Who are we? Where are we going? What do we fear?" "Start at the beginning," she told herself, holding to her sanity, as she felt the adobe floor underfoot. "My name is Anne Kristen. My husband's name is Roger. We were born in the year 2155 A.D., and we lived in a world that was evil, a world that was like a great black ship pulling away from the shore of sanity and civilization, roaring its black horn in the night, taking 2 billion people with it, whether they wanted to go or not, to death, to fall over the edge of the earth and the sea into radioactive flame and madness." They walked into the cafe. The man was staring at them. A phone rang. The phone startled Susan. She remembered a phone ringing 200 years in the future, on that blue April morning in 2155, and herself answering it. "Anne, this is Renee. Have you heard? I mean about Travel in Time Incorporated? Trips to Rome in 21 BC, trips to Napoleon's Waterloo, any time, any place."
"Renee, you're joking."
"No. Clinton Smith left this morning for Philadelphia in 1776. Travel in Time, Inc. arranges everything. Costs money, but think,
to actually see the burning of Rome. Kublai Khan, Moses, and the Red Sea. You've probably got an ad in your tube mail now.
She had opened the suction mail tube, and there was the metal foil advertisement. Rome and the Borgias. The Wright Brothers at Kitty Hawk. Travel in Time, Inc. can costume you, put you in a crowd during the assassination of Lincoln or Caesar. We guarantee to teach you any language you need to move freely in any civilization in any year without friction. Latin, Greek, ancient American colloquial. Take your vacation in time as well as place. Renee's voice was buzzing on the phone.
Tom and I leave for 1492 tomorrow. They're arranging for Tom to sail with Columbus. Isn't it amazing?
Yes, murmured Anne, stunned.
What does the government say about this time machine company?
Oh, the police have an eye on it. Afraid people might evade the draft, run off and hide in the past, everyone has to leave a security bond behind, his house and belongings, to guarantee return. After all, the war's on.
Yes, the war, murmured Anne. The war.
Standing there holding the phone, she had thought. Here is the chance my husband and I have talked and prayed over for so many years. We don't like this world of 2155. We want to run away from his work at the bomb factory. I, from my position with disease culture units, perhaps there is a chance for us to escape, to run for centuries into a wild country of years where they will never find and bring us back to burn our books, censor our thoughts, scald our minds with fear, march us, scream at us with radios. They were in Mexico in the year 1938. She looked at the stained cafe wall. Good workers for the future state were allowed vacations into the past to escape fatigue. And so she and her husband had moved back into 1938, a room in New York City, and enjoyed the theaters and the Statue of Liberty, which still stood green in the harbor. And on the third day, they had changed their clothes, their names, and had flown off to hide in Mexico.
It must be him,
whispered Susan, looking at the stranger seated at the table.
Those cigarettes, the cigars, the liquor, they give him away. Remember our first night in the past?
A month ago, their first night in New York, before their flight, drinking all the strange drinks, savoring and buying odd foods, perfumes, cigarettes of 10 dozen rare brands, for they were rare in the future, where war was everything. So they had made fools of themselves, rushing in and out of stores, salons, tobacconists, going up to their room to get wonderfully ill. And now here was this stranger doing likewise, doing a thing that only a man from the future would do, who had been starved for liquors and cigarettes for many years.